Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to today's occasional lecture. And it's a very, very great pleasure today to welcome Cheryl Saunders to talk to us about the scope of the executive power. Cheryl really is one of those people who needs no introduction, but she is one of Australia's best known and most highly regarded constitutional scholars. And in addition to her AO, the French government has recently honoured her with its a knight in the National Order of the Legion of Honour. I'm not sure what that means we call you, Cheryl, but... anyway, it is a very great pleasure to have Cheryl here today. And I don't want to delay proceedings, so I'll invite you to welcome her to the podium. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Well, I was very pleased, in fact, to have been invited to deliver the lecture today. And I'd like to use it to bring together two related themes. One is the heavy reliance on government through the use of executive power in Australia. And the other is the course of High Court decisions over the last decade or so that have placed new emphasis on the need to identify the parameters of federal executive power by reference to the rest of the Constitution. While, of course, much executive power is exercised pursuant to statute, the extent to which the executive can act without legislative authority in the exercise of what's often called its inherent executive power creates some complex questions. For the moment, the relevant cases culminate in a case called Williams and the Commonwealth, although more litigation can be expected. My purpose in this lecture is to explain what has happened so far and to argue that these developments offer an opportunity to craft through law and practice an appropriate sphere for the use of inherent power, executive power in 21st century Australia. I begin by outlining the challenges of understanding the meaning of the key provision of the Constitution, Section 61. In this part, I'll also briefly canvass the types of cases about executive power that came before the High Court in the first century of Federation, so as to show how and why the meaning of the section remains unsettled. In the next part, I identify some of the patterns of use of executive power and explain the incentive for usage to increase, fueled by the ambiguity of the power. Part four examines recent decisions of the High Court with particular reference to Williams, explores their implications for the scope of the power, and identifies some of the key questions that remain for decision. In conclusion, I will try to persuade you that while these developments, of course, have their challenges, they should be welcomed by the Parliament and the executive branch itself for their potential to enhance the Australian constitutional system. The effectiveness of Australian constitutionalism depends to a greater extent than in any other Western democracy on the vertical and horizontal allocation of power between healthy public institutions. The scope of federal executive power affects all the key constitutional principles that frame these institutional relationships: federalism, representative and responsible government, separation of powers, and the rule of law. Now, a couple of words of warning before we begin the serious stuff. This is quite a complicated story, and because of that, I've produced a few slides really just to try and get some of the more dense text before your eyes as well as in your ears. And the second point I should make is that I'm myself still thinking through this case in some respects, and so while you will get a draft of my speech at the end, it is actually just a draft, and I'll give it a little bit more thought before it appears in final published form. So let's do it. The Commonwealth Constitution, as you know, drew on both the British and the United States strands of the common law constitutional tradition. As a generalisation, the institutions that it established are largely British in conception, although they were, of course, overlaid by federalism. The British Constitution, in turn, is evolutionary and unwritten, in the sense that there's no single codified constitutional document, so that the applicable principles have emerged in response to events over a very long period of time. At the core of the British Constitution is the relationship between the executive and a sovereign parliament, reinforced by the authority of independent courts to resolve disputes over the lawfulness of executive action and the meaning of legislation. Two lines of that development are relevant for present purposes. One is the passage of de facto executive power from the monarch to ministers with the confidence of the elected House. But formal power remained with the monarch, and one effect of that was to inhibit the emergence of a developed concept of the state. A second line of development marked the boundaries between power that could be exercised by the executive alone and that which required authorisation from the parliament. The former included powers that originated in the prerogative of the monarch, for example, the power to make war and conclude treaties. But it also included some powers of a kind that can generally be exercised by legal persons as long as they're not prohibited by law, of which a power to contract is an example. Now, this is an oversimplification of the results of a very complex history. And that history left unsettled a range of matters, including the scope and purpose of that narrow concept of the prerogative and the question whether it included the other non-statutory powers of the Crown or not. In recent years, in the United Kingdom itself, the uncertainty has led to debate on a host of questions, which in some respects parallel issues confronting Australia. These include the legal character of the Crown and the relevance of that to the scope of non-statutory executive powers, particularly in an age in which such powers are used for programmatic purposes, whether and to what extent the Crown can properly be equated with private persons for the purpose of identifying what the executive might lawfully do, the efficacy of accountability to Parliament for the exercise of inherent executive power, whether and to what extent an exercise of either the prerogative in the narrow sense or the other non-statutory executive powers should require prior authorisation by statute, and whether and in what circumstances a parliamentary appropriation constitutes adequate parliamentary approval. The framers of the Australian Constitution faced the challenge of adapting this historically derived British conception of the executive and its authority to the very different Australian context of a written entrenched constitution which was both federal and perceived to be democratically advanced, and in which executive power would formally be exercised by appointed representatives of the Crown. The result was a brief section on executive power in a brief chapter of the Constitution dealing with the executive branch. Section 61 provides, as it is on the screen, the executive power of the Commonwealth is vested in the Queen, exercisable by the Governor-General, and extends to the execution and maintenance of this Constitution and the laws of the Commonwealth. Relevantly for present purposes, as you'll see, the Parliament may make laws with respect to matters incidental to the execution of whatever power Section 61 vests in the government of the Commonwealth, and we'll come back to that section in due course. Now, if you look at Section 61, there are at least two obvious words of limitation in it. One is the requirement for the power to be executive in character, and the contrast there is clearly with legislative and judicial power. The other is the need for the executive power to pertain to the Commonwealth, in contrast, in this case, to the states. The precise scope of neither of these limitations is apparent on the face of the section, however, and it's unclear whether those final clauses, beginning from extends to, whether those final clauses are words of limitation or not. Nor is it clear whether, and if so how, the old British understanding of executive power informs the section. Does Section 61 allow for the prerogative in the narrow sense, and if so, to what extent? Does it allow for the so-called ordinary non-statutory executive powers, and again, if so, to what extent? Does it allow for potential new forms of executive action, some of which are driven by federalism, of which intergovernmental agreements are an example? Now, no section in a constitution can properly be interpreted in isolation from the rest of the instrument, and in the case of executive power, the relevant context has several dimensions. Most obviously relevant are the provisions dealing with federalism. Both legislative and executive power are explicitly divided between the Commonwealth and the states. Section 109 resolves inconsistencies between Commonwealth and state laws. Section 96 enables the Commonwealth to make grants to the states. A section in which all original states are equally represented has almost co-equal powers with the House of Representatives, and the more limited powers of the Senate in relation to financial legislation is closely circumscribed. A second group of provisions relates to representative government, legislative powers vested in a parliament. Both houses of parliament are directly elected. The parliament exercises financial control through those appropriation provisions in sections 81 and 83. And a third group of provisions concerns responsible government. Particularly relevant for present purposes is the requirement in section 64 that the so-called officers who administer the departments of state are both advisers to the Governor-General and ministers who must hold seats in the parliament. The meaning of section 61 has arisen before the court in particular contexts many times since Federation. Luckily for you, we don't have time to canvass the detail of all of that case law now. But let me just assign it to three categories for explanatory purposes. Broadly speaking, there is one category of cases in which the main question has been, is the power executive in character? And this, in generally, in those circumstances, it's obvious that it pertains to the Commonwealth. There's another category of cases in which it's readily been accepted that the power is executive in character, but the question is whether it pertains to the Commonwealth rather than the states. And then there's a third category, which we'll put aside for the moment, dealing with other aspects of the executive power. As far as the first category is concerned, right from the beginning, there's been tension about whether, given the wording of Section 61, constitutional or statutory authority is always required for the exercise of executive power, or whether the various common law understandings of inherent executive power inform a broader reading of the section in some way. Arguments in favour of that latter broader view included, as Deakin once suggested, that executive power existed before legislation, that the Commonwealth executive had all the common law powers of a legal person, and that the description of executive power in Section 61 as extending to certain matters was not intended to restrict its scope. These claims have never been accepted in their entirety by the High Court, but nevertheless it's been confirmed over the decades since Federation, that, for example, Section 61 does indeed incorporate some aspects of the prerogative, including the power to make treaties, that it authorises the executive to enter into at least some contracts without legislative authority, and that it is the source of the power to make intergovernmental agreements. The second category of cases concerns the scope of Commonwealth vis-à-vis state executive power. It has some links with the first, insofar as a broad power for the Commonwealth executive to exercise all the powers of a legal person to contract potentially denies any federal limitations on the power at all. But many, although not all, of the most significant cases focused on the related question of the Commonwealth power to spend. Until the latter part of the 20th century, it had been assumed that the answer to this question lay in the meaning of the requirement in Section 81 of the Constitution for the Consolidated Revenue Fund to be appropriated for the purposes of the Commonwealth. But in 1975, following a challenge to the validity of a regional assistance plan in the Australian Assistance Plan case, the focus shifted. Now, the outcome of that case, which was decided in 1975, was frustratingly inconclusive. The challenge was dismissed after Justice Stephen, the seventh member of an otherwise equally divided court, decided that the plaintiff state didn't have standing. But the reasoning of the remaining justices was instructive. While some justices interpreted Section 81, the appropriation provision, broadly to encompass whatever purposes Parliament determined, one of those justices, Justice Mason, pointed to the distinction between appropriation on the one hand and engaging in a spending program on the other. The latter depended on executive power as a last resort. And in this case, in his view, the program that was in issue in this case exceeded the bounds of executive power. And in what subsequently became an authoritative statement, he made this observation about Section 61. It's not unlimited. Its content does not reach beyond the area of responsibilities allocated to the Commonwealth by the Constitution, responsibilities ascertainable from the distribution of powers, and the character and status of the Commonwealth as a national government. And there are two components of that statement. One is what he says about determining the breadth of Section 61 or ascertaining it from the distribution of federal power. And the second is the add-on, the character and status of the Commonwealth as a national government. Now, so much for the early cases. Let's talk a little bit now about the nature of executive power itself. The strengths of inherent executive power are that it can be used quickly and strategically in ways that are flexible and informal. In Commonwealth-state relations, it may also, at least superficially, reflect consensus rather than ownership by one sphere of government. Executive power performs a valuable role in government for these reasons. But the flip side is that it has less desirable properties. It lacks the legitimacy, public exposure, quality control, and accountability that typically are or should be associated with legislation. In any system, therefore, it's necessary to strike an appropriate balance between reliance on executive and legislative power. Constitutions provide the framework for this, and the framework in Australia is still being settled through these various High Court decisions. But within that framework, it's up to the governments and parliaments to justify the choices that they make by reference to the principles at stake. There are various incentives for governments to resort to the use of executive power, generally and in particular in the Commonwealth sphere. Most obviously, it avoids the need for legislative approval, including passage by the Senate, in which, more often than not, governments lack a majority. A requirement for appropriation, where it exists, has never been much of a hurdle in the budget context, and is less so since the high level of abstraction of the description of the purpose of an appropriation was accepted by the High Court in Combe without any sort of remedial response from the Parliament. Reliance on executive power also appears to avoid several of the few guarantees of rights in the Constitution dealing with property and religion, and does not attract parliamentary scrutiny under the new procedures for human rights protection. Recourse to inherent executive power minimises and partly eradicates review of the lawfulness of executive action. The Administrative Decisions Judicial Review Act, for example, including its right to reasons, applies only to decisions pursuant to legislation. Review is procedurally possible under the alternative avenues of the Judiciary Act and the Constitution, but there presently is uncertainty about the standards of lawfulness that apply. Administrative Appeals Tribunal review also is available only for decisions under legislation. Even review of the constitutionality of executive action is complicated by the nature of the proceedings and the character of the instruments before the court. And these various incentives to the use of executive power are further fuelled by the ambiguity over the constitutional scope of executive power, insofar as those earlier cases leave open the possibility either that the ambit of executive power is significantly wider than that of legislative power, or that it offers the potential to broaden legislative power through the use of that express incidental power that we looked at on the screen a moment ago. Now, of course, cause and effect is almost impossible to establish in a situation of this kind. Nevertheless, Australian governments do rely very extensively on the use of executive power unsupported by legislation. The tendency is particularly striking in two spheres of domestic activity, and I leave completely to one side the non-domestic activity in which the executive also, of course, plays a very significant role. One of these spheres of domestic activity is intergovernmental relations. A very considerable proportion of government in Australia takes place in the exercise of executive power under the rubric of intergovernmental relations, largely bypassing the systemic procedures for political and legal accountability. The abandonment of the former terminology of ministerial council in favour of reference to the COAG council system without any public deliberation at all is merely another straw in the wind. I acknowledge that there have been various attempts to enhance transparency and accountability, and we won't pause to explore them now. But my point is that the development of a dense network of arrangements around the purely executive institution of COAG is an issue that Australians need to think about comprehensively sooner rather than later from the perspective of the democratic structure of government. But we're less concerned with that aspect of the executive power today than we are with the second area that I want to spend a little more time on, and that is what the Commonwealth Ombudsman has described as executive schemes. In a 2009 report triggered by public complaints about several such schemes, the Ombudsman identified both the strengths and weaknesses of the implementation of programs through executive action alone, with particular reference to accessibility to the public, consistency of decision-making, and accountability. The Ombudsman report explores a series of case studies in depth, providing useful insights into some of the difficulties that arise. It didn't seek to quantify the number of such schemes, but thanks to the recent legislative reaction to the decision in the Williams case, it's now clear that there were at least 420 such programs that were thought to have been put at risk by that decision. The list in the legislation doesn't make gripping reading, but it's a mine of information about this aspect of government activity. The most famous executive scheme for the moment is the National Schools Chaplaincy Program. This is the scheme that was challenged in Williams, and it's worth focusing on it briefly, not only for that reason, but also as an example of its kind. The scheme provided funding to assist schools to establish or extend chaplaincy services. It involved a commitment to expenditure of $207 million over a five-year period beginning in 2006. Parallel programs operated in many states, and the Commonwealth also provides Section 96 grants to states for schools. The first appropriation to fund the program was made in Appropriation Act No. 3, 2006-07. The framework of rules for the program takes the form of administrative guidelines, including a code of conduct, which were incorporated to the extent relevant into contracts made by the Commonwealth with service providers in relation to particular schools. The guidelines were revised within government at least three times between 2006 and 2011, and further changes were made in 2012. Amongst other things, several of these later changes extended the arrangements to allow funding for secular pastoral care workers. An Ombudsman report on the program in 2011 noted that there was insufficient guidance in program documentation on, amongst other things, key terms, including pastoral care and proselytise, and on minimum qualification requirements. As this description demonstrates, the chaplaincy program, let me call it that for short, is a purely executive program operating through spending pursuant to contracts in an area of primarily state responsibility. Even the initial appropriation was affected in the bill-making provision for the ordinary annual services of government, despite the compact between the House and the Senate of 1965. The multiple changes made to the program guidelines during its relatively short life are of a kind that should have been obviated by the greater care that attends policy formulation and drafting through legislation. Most importantly of all, perhaps, this is a significant policy initiative in a country where considerations of both multiculturalism and secularism suggest that the introduction of chaplains into schools requires sensitivity, careful program design, and public debate. In Williams, the father of children at the Darling Heights State School in Queensland challenged the validity of the agreement under the program in relation to this school and the payments made pursuant to it. The decision in Williams didn't come out of the blue, but it's the latest in a string of cases in which the High Court has stressed the need to understand Commonwealth executive power by reference to the text and structure of the written constitution. I took you back to Section 61 too quickly. With hindsight, an early seed was planted in the very different circumstances of the Tampa litigation in 2001, when Justice French, then sitting as a member of the full court of the Federal Court, said this: "The executive power of the Commonwealth under Section 61 is not just a species of the royal prerogative. The executive power may derive some of its content by reference to the royal prerogative, but it's a power conferred as part of a negotiated federal compact expressed in a written constitution, distributing powers between the three arms of government reflected in chapters 1, 2, and 3 of the constitution, and between the polities that comprise the federation." When I first saw that statement in 2001, I thought, goodness, where are we going here? And now 10 years later, I think we can perhaps see. Almost contemporaneously, with the Tampa case was the High Court decision in Queen against Hughes, in which the court noted that the scope of the executive power remains open to some debate. Later in the decade, in another different context, the High Court confirmed that a Section 61 agreement with the states could not facilitate a payment to the states that was not authorised by Section 96 because it purported to acquire property or to authorise the acquisition of property other than on just terms. But for present purposes, the immediate forerunner of the Williams decision was the decision in Pape. Pape involved a challenge to the tax bonus legislation that formed part of the Australian fiscal stimulus package. The most likely source of power was the incidental legislative power in support of that aspect of the executive power that was described in the Australian Assistance Plan case as giving the Commonwealth a capacity to engage in activities peculiarly adapted to the government of a nation which cannot otherwise be carried on for the benefit of the nation. That's the nationhood power, which I pointed out to you a moment ago. Despite disparities between the reasoning of the judges, Pape established, with hindsight, at least three propositions. First, the source of the power to spend lies in Section 61 and not in the appropriation provisions. Secondly, the Commonwealth's power to spend is not unlimited, although in Pape itself it was sustained as an exercise of the nationhood power. And thirdly, Section 5139, the incidental legislative power, is also constrained, particularly when used in support of the legislative of the executive power. And in particular, there's some constraints on it to be used for the enactment of what the court describes as coercive laws. But in Williams, the question of the scope of the executive power was raised in a very different context to Pape. The main target of the challenge in Williams was the contract to which Commonwealth spending was necessarily incidental. There was no legislation, so no question arose about the scope of the incidental legislative power, and nor was this a case in which the activity in question might be supported by the nationhood power. On the contrary, the states themselves were already engaged in similar programs. When the case began, it seemed likely that the outcome would turn mainly on the question of whether the challenged action, the making of these contracts and the spending, could have been the subject of legislation. This perception drew on what came to be described in the case as the common assumption of parties that the executive power extends at least to engagement in activities which could be authorised by a law made by the Parliament. Two possible heads of power were claimed by the Commonwealth for this purpose. One was the corporation's power, because the Scripture Union of Queensland, with whom the contract was made, was a trading corporation, and the other was the power to make laws for the provision of benefits to students. In the end, three of the seven justices of the court approached the problem on that basis. Two of those three justices held that neither head of power was applicable, and they would have invalidated the contract on that basis. The third would have upheld the contract by reference to the benefits to students' power. In the event of the failure of the argument based on that, quote, common assumption, the Commonwealth had an alternative, broader position, which drew on the concept of the executive as a legal person with an unlimited power to contract. This argument was put, but it failed. It's now established, if it wasn't before, that the Commonwealth as a whole constitutes a polity within which authority is allocated between the various branches according to the Constitution, including, in relation to the executive branch, Section 61. The executive power is not unlimited in any of its aspects. Quite apart from the obvious relevance of the federal division of power, the presence in the Constitution of Section 96, the grants power, as a mechanism through which the states are offered and have the option to accept grants on condition, militated against an understanding of the executive power that would have made Section 96 redundant. In any event, the court denied that conclusions about the scope of Commonwealth power could satisfactorily be derived by analogy from the capacities of legal persons, given the public character of Commonwealth funds, its accountability obligations, and the coercive mechanisms at its disposal. Now, these findings alone make the Williams case significant, but much of the interest of the case, in fact, derives from the treatment of that common assumption by a majority of the court. During the course of the hearing, the tenor of the argument put to the court changed in a way that persuaded these justices to approach the question of the validity of the contract rather differently. This meant that they were no longer prepared to assume that the power to contract was always necessarily executive in character, so that the only outstanding issue was whether a contract fell within the Commonwealth sphere. The question thus became whether a contract of this kind required supporting legislation rather than merely the possibility of supporting legislation, determined by reference to what Chief Justice French described as a hypothetical law. To answer this question, the court, these four judges, drew on the rest of the constitutional context, ultimately concluding that this contract, the contract for chaplaincy services to the Darling Heights High School, did not fall within inherent executive power and therefore needed the support of statutory authority. Now, while the emphases again between the reasons of the judges differed somewhat, all pointed to constitutional provisions dealing with federalism and representative government. The relationship between the legislature and the executive is relevant to both, given the role of the Senate in the original conception of the Constitution as the house through which the states have a say in legislation. By contrast, neither house is involved in the exercise of executive power beyond the function of appropriation, in relation to which the powers of the Senate are limited. In the absence of legislation, moreover, there is no constitutional rule to resolve inconsistency between the exercise of federal and state executive power where, as in the circumstances of Williams, there's potential for conflict between the two. Let me conclude this part by summarising what I presently take to be the effects of this complicated case. In considering whether government action that is not authorised by legislation is supported by Section 61, it's necessary to consider not only the division of power between the Commonwealth and the states, but also the relationship between the executive and the parliament. Both are relevant in examining contract and spending programs. At least some such programs will require authorising legislation, which may, of course, expose the absence of an adequate head of legislative power. The touchstone for making these decisions is the text of Section 61, such as it is, understood in the context of the rest of the Constitution. Both the power in the nature of the prerogative and the power derived from nationhood are untouched by Williams, at least directly, and remain sources of inherent executive power subject to federal limitations. And of course, we can expect that they will be further refined in other kinds of cases. The potential for conflict with state executive power is an indicator that the limits of Commonwealth executive power may have been reached. The judgments also suggest, some more explicitly than others, that there is a range of activities, including contracting, which are undertaken in what the court describes as the ordinary course of administering a recognised part of the government of the Commonwealth, that fall within the scope of inherent executive power on the basis that they involve the execution and maintenance of the Constitution. Distinguishing those so-called ordinary contracts from programmatic contracts of the kind invalidated in Williams is one of many challenges presented by this case for the future. Now, the immediate reaction to Williams on the part of the government and parliament was to enact legislation designed to reverse it. The Financial Framework Legislation Amendment Act No. 3 of 2012, which I'll describe as the Amendment Act, purports to retrospectively validate more than 400 executive programs, including the chaplaincy program, and to authorise additional programs to receive statutory approval through regulation. The substantive validating provision in the amending Act confers power on the Commonwealth to administer an arrangement in the regulations subject to law if, apart from this subsection, the Commonwealth does not otherwise have power to do so. And I'm sorry, I should have put that up on the screen for you too, but I didn't. Decisions under this section are excluded from the operation of the Administrative Decisions Judicial Review Act, and therefore no reasons. Each program is described in terms of very general outcomes. The only information about the chaplaincy program, for example, is that its objective is to assist school communities to support the well-being of their students, including by strengthening values, providing pastoral care, and enhancing engagement with the broader community. Now, the Act itself would be worthy of another lecture, and I'm not angling for another invitation. There's a question about whether that general validating section is effective for the purpose. Even if it is, there's another question about whether the Act is valid in relation to each of the programs, in the sense that a head of power can be found for each of them. The description of the school chaplaincy program, which I read out to you a moment ago, for example, certainly doesn't encourage reliance on the corporation's power, and it doesn't necessarily meet the description of the provision of benefits to students either. However problematic the legislation for the purposes for which it was enacted, and we'll find that out in due course, however, the mere fact that it provides statutory authority for these programs, however vague the authority, has political and perhaps legal implications. Any new program added by regulation presumably should attract the attention of the Senate Standing Committee on Regulations and Ordinances, which, according to its terms of reference, should ask whether it makes rights unduly dependent on administrative decisions that are not subject to independent merits review, and whether it contains matter more appropriate for parliamentary enactment. Both the new legislation and any amending regulations also should be subject to a statement of compatibility and examined by the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Human Rights by reference to the 7 human rights treaties that fall within its remit. It remains to be seen whether the existence of a statutory setting also affects the processes of judicial review. I suggested at the outset of this lecture that Williams provides the opportunity to craft a conception of executive power that's suitable for 21st century Australia. From that standpoint, the Amendment Act is a disappointment. Temporary validating legislation of some kind would have been understandable, not only because of the politics of the sudden cessation of these programs, but because of the anxiety that the decision caused in the short term to recipients of federal funds pursuant to them. Legislation in this form, however, is appropriate only as a stopgap while more tailored and longer-term solutions are found. The responsibility for such solutions lies with all branches and spheres of government, including this Parliament. In time, there will be more litigation, and the contours of the constitutional definition of executive power will be developed further. But it's essential also for the Parliament to have a principled view about the policies and programs that should be dignified by legislation. And it's desirable for the states to work out with their Commonwealth counterparts how Section 96 might be used more efficiently to administer spending programs that continue to exist. And the executive should welcome these developments as well, although I'm sure that it doesn't presently think so. At a time of financial constraint, there's much to be gained from procedures that ensure that spending programs are not undertaken hastily, that there's a broad-based commitment to them, that they're well designed and implemented, and that the money is well spent. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Cheryl. You've taken us on a very lucid path through a very complex issue. And I think you've given us lots of food for thought. Now, we've got a little bit of time for questions. And if you've got a question, I invite you to come to the microphone, either on the floor down here or upstairs in the gallery. And I'm sure you'll be happy to field questions, Cheryl.
Sure.
I suppose this is not so much a question perhaps as a comment, and that is about the, as you mentioned at the end, the challenge to the Parliament to take up the implications of the Williams case and the government's response to the Williams case, which the Parliament agreed to. It should have perhaps been a stopgap measure, but it's now become a permanent measure. It was passed with great urgency by both houses because there were very compelling reasons to fix up this problem that the High Court had exposed through the Williams decision. But now we're left with this huge delegation of power to the executive to make regulations to validate all sorts of programs that may or may not have a connection with Commonwealth legislative power. And I'm wondering, you know, how the structures of the Parliament might be up to that challenge.
Well, of course, there is a question about that, particularly in the wake of COMBE, where the structures of the Parliament weren't up to the challenge. And look, it may well be that, there's all sorts of imponderables here. One is whether the legislation will survive challenge, or if the chaplaincy scheme comes back, whether its description will survive challenge. But there's a sense in which the Parliament won't be able to avoid this entirely. I mean, again, if you think about the terms of reference of the Senate Regs and Ordinances Committee, I mean, all of these regulations are its job, and they have terms of reference which are remarkably useful. Now, of course, it can dodge it, but nevertheless, the question will have to be considered at some stage. Mm.
Please come to the microphone.
Thank you very much
for that. It was very interesting. I'm not sure how much, but I'll remember. What I wanted to ask about was going back to Justice French's decision in Tampa. Mm. As a non-lawyer, it seemed to me on reading it that it almost allowed unlimited power to the executive in my understanding, non-legal understanding, which effectively equates with the government of the day. So I wonder if you could just comment a little bit further on that.
Yes, look, I mean, I was not happy about the Tampa decision either. And there are several aspects of the Tampa decision. One is what the court said about the scope of executive power, and the other was what the court said about the relationship between executive power and legislative power, given that there was a Migration Act. And so the question was the extent to which the executive power survived the enactment of legislation. But I think that what was actually found by the majority in the Tampa case in relation to executive power is not as broad as all that. If you look at the way in which Justice French, with whom Justice Beaumont agreed in the Tampa litigation, you look at the way in which he framed the executive power that he found to exist. It wasn't as broad, for example, as the executive power that Chief Justice Black was playing with. Nevertheless, you know, there was concern at the time that this seemed to be a new sort of executive power, and where did it come from? And it's really in that context that quotation from Justice French at the time, you looked at that and said, oh my God, is this a recipe for continuing to expand executive power? Now that questions of executive power are beginning to come up in other contexts, what we're seeing instead is that the idea that the executive power is our executive power, not just an inherited one that needs to fit within the bounds of the Constitution, it may be expansive in some circumstances, but will be also cause its retraction in others. So what we're seeing is the tailoring of executive power by reference to the Constitution as a whole. It's quite an interesting time, really, from that point of view.
Do we have another question? Yes, come up to the microphone. That way everybody can hear you.
Forgive me if I pronounce Anne's last name incorrectly. Toomey or Toomey?
Anne Toomey, yes.
Toomey. Mm-hmm. I'm an ANU law student, and there's a group of us here, and we have an assignment due.
Oh, look, I'm touched by the size of the audience.
You know, they only take up a row, so everyone else is here for deeper personal interests. So Anne
I'll
Toomey...
I'll ask for a show of hands.
Anne Toomey, she said that the PAPE decision was a lost opportunity to examine and limit the scope of executive government. How would you respond to that?
I'm not sure that we know the answer to that question yet. Of course it is true. PAPE is interesting, as you, of course, as ANU law students doing an assignment know, because you get an outcome in PAPE, a majority decision for a particular outcome, but a different majority for a set of principles. And the majority for the set, at least, I'm forgetting the numbers now, but at least two or three of the sort of potential dissentients in PAPE really constitute a majority for limiting the executive power by reference to principle. So insofar as the actual outcome in PAPE doesn't reflect that statement of views about the effect of federal limitations on the executive power, I suppose so. On the other hand, as the court said in PAPE and said again in Williams reflecting on PAPE, PAPE was a very particular set of circumstances. What was perceived as an economic crisis requiring a quick and speedy reaction by governments. I mean, we as a country are still all debating whether that was so or not, but at the time, if you think back to the sort of angst, it was easy to understand it. So I don't think you can read too much into PAPE myself. because I think we're still seeing the playing out of PAPE and the playing out of this process of accommodating the very vague terms of Section 61 to the rest of the Constitution.
Thank you.
And I want to be footnoted.
Come to the microphone.
Cheryl, now that the genie's out of the bottle, mm-hmm. and given the uncertainties around the effect and validity of the Amendment Act, to what extent do you think that the legislative intervention has actually reduced uncertainty?
In relation to some programs, it probably has. I mean, if you look down the list of... on the assumption that the general statute itself is valid, that the sort of very general enabling provision works, which I guess is something that we need to think about. But a lot of the programs that were sort of added in there, dealing with veterans affairs, for example, clearly survive on federalism-type grounds. So perhaps it gave people some comfort in that respect. And it certainly postponed the evil day. But I think unless both government and parliament turn their minds to really thinking rather more deeply about the various categories of exercise of executive power now and craft appropriate legislative solutions, I think that the uncertainty that you refer to will bubble on and continue to haunt all of us, including the court.
I'm just wondering, just in terms of if there's going to be a change of government, for example, there may be cuts to grants programs. Do you think that if there's a contract that's ongoing and they're cutting the grant, that they would then need to change the regulations?
Not necessarily, I think, but I must say I haven't looked at the legislation for that purpose. I don't want to answer off the cuff because I really need to look at it and think about that. My immediate assumption is no, but that may not be right. I mean, clearly some of these contracts are going to end anyway, and you know, even if they're not arbitrarily cut, and so the it must have been envisaged that the arrangements would naturally come to an end, but whether they contemplated taking him out. Actually, perhaps they should. I mean, otherwise it would be a mess. So maybe. Thank you for the question.
The contract is probably of greater force than the appropriation, because the appropriation is simply an authorisation. It doesn't force...
But we're now talking about the regulation as well, and these things are actually in the regulations until they're taken out of the regulation. So in that sense, I think your question's a very interesting one.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Professor. I'm Neil James from the Defence Association. This is a question from a simple soldier and not a lawyer. But in the battle between inherent power and the power derived from statutory authority, wouldn't it be correct to say that just as the defence heads of power in the Constitution and the power the executive has as a result wax and wane depending on the defence threat, that much of the executive power of the Commonwealth wouldn't be fixed no matter what we do, because it will wax and wane depending on the crisis involved, if it indeed is a power for dealing with a crisis?
Well, the power for dealing with the crisis is only a very small part of the executive power itself, and that's certainly not what we're talking about in relation to Williams. And it's got to be a fair old crisis that we're talking about as well. Now, if it's a defence crisis, you're not going to need to rely... it's not going to be such a difficulty in any event, because that clearly falls within the Commonwealth realm. The reason why PAPE was interesting was because it wasn't so obvious that that fell within the Commonwealth realm. So I don't think that the analogy of waxing and waning really helps terribly much with the executive power.
Up in the gallery.
I'm wondering if you could comment on possible comparisons with other countries, while noting that there might not be many that have the federations with written constitutions in the common law system, but I'm wondering if other countries have dealt with this issue of executive power and where they might be at.
Yes. It's a very interesting comparative project, actually. Exactly how interesting, I hadn't really fully understood till I started preparing this paper. In relation to other countries similar to us in the sense that they inherited institutions originally from the UK, there is a similar debate going on. There's been a debate in the UK itself. A lot of it there has revolved around the issues that I deliberately dodged here, namely defence and external affairs. And much of the debate there was prompted by the government's decision to engage in the Second Gulf War without recourse to Parliament. So there's been a big debate in the United Kingdom about whether both the prerogative in the narrow sense on the one hand and these sort of so-called ordinary executive powers on the other should in some way be tamed by legislation. Others have engaged in that debate as well. There's a very interesting series of articles by an Israeli woman called Margaret Cohen, who's done a lot of comparative work in the area and come up with some solutions of her own, one of which I actually quote in the paper, about where the sorts of lines might be drawn between inherent powers to contract and powers to contract that need statutory authority, for example. If you move outside the British common law tradition to, say, the continental legal tradition or versions of it, you find an entirely different ballgame. I mean, there, because there's no notion of inherent executive power, pre-existing constitutions that has survived, they just assume that you will find your executive power either in legislation or in the constitution. And that is, of course, the logic of a written constitution, but it just takes a while to work around to it. So there are some very interesting comparisons, I think, to be drawn with, for example, Germany in how the concept of executive power has developed and its relationship with both the constitution and legislation.
Thank you for your lecture. My question may be beyond your brief today. It refers to sections 59 and 60 of the Constitution. Section 61, and I think you've already mentioned in your speech, allows for a narrow prerogative of the monarchy. A recent letter to the Canberra Times raised the question of a possible referendum law passed by Parliament for the establishment of a republic, even before the referendum had been put, could fail to receive assent from the Crown, the Queen. I'm not sure whether anything in my question relates to your theme, but if you'd care to comment, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Look, I haven't seen that letter, so I probably shouldn't comment on that. But it doesn't really relate to the theme, except in the very general sense that, and I'd actually spared you this complication. But one of the other things that's happened over the last 100 years, of course, is that not only there's been changes in the way in which executive power is exercised and changes in the way in which the court has interpreted executive power, but there's been changes in the relationship between the United Kingdom and Australia, with Australia becoming independent at some point, also undefined, during that time. Now, that also actually has affected the meaning of Section 61. I briefly mentioned in passing another section, Section 2 of the Constitution, I mentioned it only on the slide, which authorises the Queen to confer certain powers and functions on the Governor-General. Now, that's a reference to the period that immediately followed Federation, when Australia was not fully independent and didn't have a full complement of prerogative power anyway, even if we're still talking in terms of prerogative power. So the full power to enter into treaties and declare war on part of Australia was not in Section 61 in 1902. It still lay with the United Kingdom, and there was a question whether additional powers might be passed over under Section 2. Now, subsequently, Australia became fully independent. The court interpreted Section 61 as picking up all those extra powers, and Section 2 became redundant. But this is part of the backdrop of understanding Section 61 as well. And the reason I make those points is because the two sections that the questioner just referred to are also parts of the Constitution which have in effect become redundant over time for precisely the same reasons.
Sadly, our time is up. But I'd like you to thank Cheryl Saunders for taking us through a very complex subject with great skill. And good luck to those ANU students in your assignment.
Exactly.